Hello and welcome to A Storm of Spoilers off season tour. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and if I'm picking a Rian Johnson character that I would like to inhabit, it's got to be Brendan from Brick, because he could take a hit and keep on ticking.
I'm Joanna Robinson, and if I had to pick a character from the Rian Johnson verse that I would inhabit, given my recent bout of laryngitis, I gotta go with Bang Bang from the Brothers Bloom, who's says so much without saying anything at all.
And I'm Neil Miller, and if I were to inhabit a character in the Rian Johnson universe, it would be Penelope from Brothers Bloom, played by Rachel Weisz, because she's super rich and optimistic and delightful. She's like the most delightful. So I would want to be that.
Are you working on your pinhole camera technique?
Yes, with watermelons.
Excellent. Yeah, yes. And probably like a dozen other things.
Skateboarding, juggling chainsaws. Yeah.
Rapping, how cool would it be DJing. To just collect hobbies? That's like the best in my mind. That's the best.
Isn't that sort of what we're doing here on Storm of Spoilers? The podcast, while Game of Thrones is not on, is taking looks at different things in the off season. And this
pretty
week,
much.
We're doing Rian Johnson because he has a Star Wars movie coming out. The first of probably the rest of his career making Star Wars related content. But, you know, let's not doom him yet. There are three movies to go over, plus another section at the end of the show where we'll talk a little bit about Star Wars. That one will, I'm sure, have a lot of other disclaimers about what we're going to be talking about, because none of us have seen The Last Jedi, Rian Johnson's fourth film, yet. But we will. Before we record another podcast. So, without further ado, I hope I have stalled enough for Miss Joanna Robinson to pull up some reviews.
Oh, you did not.
No. So, okay. In the future, I'll start off with the slight reminder that we're coming up on reviews.
Yeah, you'll be like, next we're doing reviews, but first I'm going to vamp for no reason.
Let me describe the show.
Well, I will say this while I will vamp while I pull this up, which is to say that, well, first of all, I want to defend Neil against the very harsh email, review that he read about himself last week. That made me really sad. So, Neil, in the future, you do not have to read negative reviews about yourself.
I like that one though.
Okay. And then the other thing I was going to, never mind. I don't have to stall anymore. Okay. So this comes from Hunter J from Dallas, and Hunter J says, the best carpool buddy, 5 stars. I hadn't considered listening to podcasts until almost 2 years ago, when all the Game of Thrones coverage I read was never enough. Giving Storm of Spoilers a go is probably the best decision on a whim I've ever made, with perhaps the Great British Baking Show as an exemption, but that's beside the point. Okay. Side note from Hunter's review, which I will get back to in a second. Someday we will have to do a Storm of Spoilers episode about the Great British Bake Off, and decide which of us is the Mary Berry and which of us is the Paul Hollywood. Okay.
I've never watched it, so that'd be another Neil watches something new.
Oh, that'd be really fun. Okay, back on point. Neil, Joanna, and Dave are not only beyond knowledgeable in Game of Thrones and other pop culture fandoms, their banter is hilarious, and their genuine friendship makes this podcast a true pleasure to listen to. If I could only count the times I've yelled responses to them when driving, forgetting that they weren't actually in the car with me. ... I listen to y'all podcasts about your health issues when y'all hit your 90s. Great stuff. P.S. Can we have a hashtag Davos Wife Watch 2018? It bothers me to no end how that man lives life to the fullest while his wife wonders his whereabouts while watching out the home window. He must have lost his ring with his fingers. Ooh, good burn, Hunter J. Thanks so much. Thanks for that great review. I had the fun experience of listening to Neil and Dave last week and yelling at them as if they could actually hear me. And I already told Dave this, but there was one point where Dave was about to spoil something and I yelled at the podcast like, no, Dave, this is where I would stop you from spoiling that. And then Dave was like, wait, I'm not going to spoil that. And I was like, oh, he heard me. It's like I'm already in your head, Dave, all the time. So
yeah, the sad secret and why we're so insane is we could hear all of you when you're back at us. Like in the middle of the night, I'll just get a response about like what I was wrong about with Tremors. And, you know, I just have to live with that.
Mm-hmm.
It's the pains of one-way communication and also being transcendently psychic. All right. With that, we're going to transition to some Game of Thrones talk with Neil, which we talked about this already. I'm assuming there's Game of Thrones talk because Sophie Turner's been talking.
Yes. The Queen in the North has been loose-lipped about season 8. I don't know if we learned a whole lot. Nope. She did sort of confirm that Thrones season 8 isn't coming until 2019, which is something we sort of assumed. But we also, she talked about the Sansa's next battle, quote unquote, which is, as she described, less about the battle of manipulation as it was with Littlefinger and more about passion. So I'm curious as to if we have any theories about who is Sansa most likely to butt heads with now that Littlefinger is gone.
Jon.
Yeah, I think Jon, she has to,
like, a pretty good one.
Try to claw back whatever Stark has left in Jon after he realizes he's not.
I was worried when she said passion that this was going to turn into a weird love triangle thing when she finds out that Jon's not really her brother.
Gross. I don't want it.
That's gross. And I don't want it at all.
I don't want it at all. I know a lot of our listeners do. I don't want it. But I will say this. She doesn't have to be in love with him to be, like, jealous of the influence that Daenerys might have over him. Do you know? Mm, so,
yeah,
like, the same thing is true of this question about Tyrion at the end of last season when he gave that weird look towards the sex cabin door on the sex boat, you know, and the question was, like, is he in love with Daenerys or is he just jealous and pissed off that his influence over her is being usurped by Jon's influence over her? And so with Sansa, it might be the same thing, given, like, how she was already in conflict with Jon over ruling the North. If he comes and he's like, hey, Daenerys, I think it's a really good idea to do this. And she's like, I don't want to. And he's like, too bad. We're the bosses now, you know. And Sansa's like, now. Yeah. And Sansa's like, wait, but I've been storing all this grain and making all these breastplates. And he's I don't care. Yeah, I don't care. And then we'll have to fight
my new dragon.
And then we'll have to spend all of season 8 fighting about who's right. And it'll be like,
I hope not. That would make the whole thing feel very small in season 8.
Well, it'll be part of the bigger whole. But anyway, sure. That would be my guess. So Dave, do you have any bright ideas?
No, I mean, I like the sound of that. I mean, I wouldn't be as against the marriage thing as you guys are, mostly because I've stopped having standards for Sansa as a self-defense mechanism. So if that's, you know, the storyline she's trapped in, that's the storyline she's trapped in, and I'm going to watch it.
Hey, listen, I'm all for whatever Sansa wants to do, because it's all about agency. If she decides that she loves Jon Snow, then that's her decision to make. Oh boy. Anyway, I'm gonna dig myself out for this next one.
Oh, I was hoping Joanna would make a sound we could keep for the soundboard that was like disapproving groan.
I don't think this is the good week to capture whatever sounds I'm making. They're not stereotypical Joanna sounds.
Yeah, we'll get it though. Next item on my list is that on the 12th, which is next week, next Tuesday, I believe, Game of Thrones Season 7 comes out on DVD and Blu-ray. I received my copy the other day. I have not yet opened it because I'm also buried in other stuff. I don't know if you guys have heard about all these awards movies that are happening.
What?
Yeah, crazy.
Awards?
But I think tonight after we're done recording, I'm going to dig into this animated feature that is attached to the Blu-ray, which is called Conquest and Rebellion. It's this 45-minute animated history of Westeros feature. So I'm looking forward to that. Everyone can get it next week. But also look, I'll probably read an article about it on Film Score Rejects. I'm pretty jazzed about all the extras. And some of the extras have already started to come out, like People Magazine debuted a online featurette about the spoils of war that was really cool. So, and they keep saying loot train, which is a real problem for me, but
oh, it's an issue. I was supposed to talk to John Bradley this week about that, about the Blu-ray release, but it's hard because I'm in New York and my schedule's really weird. And instead I talked to Christian Louboutin about Star Wars shoes for some reason. But anyway, yeah. I might still get to talk to John Bradley about this Blu-ray release, and I would love to. So that might be coming, maybe.
Yeah. I also, I think this isn't going to be anytime soon because the end of the year is huge, but for season six, I think season six or season five, I did the listen to all the commentary tracks.
Yeah.
I'm going to do that again.
Ooh.
At some point. We'll see.
When we invent time travel.
When we invent time travel. Last thing, obviously the big talk this week in the business world and the superhero world is the Fox and Disney thing, which could come as early as next week, a decision on whether or not Disney is going to buy Fox. I feel like we haven't talked about this on the show.
Maybe I'm thinking of Fighting the War. I definitely know Dave's opinion because I listen to Fighting the War Room. But maybe we haven't talked about it before.
So just quick thoughts, since it seems like it's absolutely happening. Good thing, bad thing? Is there a particular thing you're looking forward to seeing happening when this happens, especially with regard to the superhero cinema?
Dave, is it okay if I start?
Yo, please do.
Okay. I think it's a very bad thing for like in terms of monopolies and all of that. It's a fun idea to have. I want, you know, if you read Vanity Fair this month, you know that I do want Kevin Feige in charge of all the superheroes because I do think that he is the best vision for what to do with probably everyone. But I would not trade like sort of the separation of powers for, you know, some better X-Men movies or X-Men being in an Avengers movie or something like that. Like that's way less important to me than the fact that like Disney will own everything and keep owning more and more. Like I was talking today with someone about the fallout of Disney owning Hulu. Like you have to like sort of trace it all down the line of all the things that Fox owns and thinking about Disney wanting to launch its own streaming service while at the same time acquiring Hulu means to me that like, I don't know, with the exception of The Handmaid's Tale, which you can't just like make disappear, I feel like Hulu goes away, right? Like Hulu's a platform for NBC and Fox to stream their shows. And like, why does Disney want that? You know? So like, it's not great, Bob. I think this whole concept, when you get outside the idea of like, wouldn't it be cool for the Fantastic Four to hang out with Spider-Man and Captain America, which would be cool. But like, that's the micro level. The macro level is terrifying. I think that the macro level is what if Thanos were in charge of everything? So, you know, that's how I think.
I definitely agree with that. To sort of add some perspective onto what Joanna just said, 2017 movie breakdown by studios, Warner Brothers is at the top because they had 30 movies, 17 of which were actually released in 2017. The rest were straddling from 2016 or re-releases, but they ended up making a ton of money because they had that many movies. Second would be Buena Vista, which is Disney, that had 7 2017 movies. Then Universal, which had 13 2017 movies, which isn't great, but, you know, they're still number 3. Then 20th Century Fox, and then everybody else. So it's not like we're talking about a movie company that's been hobbled by failure, like, you know, Sony, or if they were to buy the Weinstein Company, where you're talking about smaller shares of the market. You're talking about 20th Century Fox, number 4 of this year, has 12.3% of the overall film market. On top of Disney's 18.1%, that's just for this year would have been a 30.4% market share, which is above Warner Brothers' 20.3% with an insane 30 movies through re-release and straddling the end of the year. Which is to say, all of the math like lines up to a stranglehold. You don't like Disney movies? Too bad. That's going to be the majority of what's in there. Superheroes is just the tip of the iceberg because pulling all of 20th Century Fox's IP brings, you know, Alien in. People are talking about if there's going to be the 20th Century Fox fanfare back in front of Star Wars. They'll have the rights to re-release the original trilogy finally. without the 20th Century Fox logo on it if they want. There are all these like weird side issues, but like Joanna was saying, the virtue of having a monopoly is that all of these things are going to get Disneyized. And luckily that means something different now than it did in like the 70s and 80s and the 50s, where it would have been like slightly more mind control thought-wise. But what it's really going to happen is it's going to make things that were sharp a little bit more bland. And we're going to see that start happening as far as entertainment. It's going to be gross. But that being said, people keep asking me, you know, all that stuff aside, what am I excited about with hero stuff? And I don't know. I'm not at that point yet. It's all bad to me at this point. I grew up in a time where I didn't think we'd see the Avengers on screen. So like I got that. And now I'm back to being concerned about overall stuff.
Yeah, a friend of the pod and my roommate for the last couple of nights, Katie Rich, was the one who pointed out when this first came up when we were talking about it, was the one who pointed out that in Cloud Atlas, David Mitchell's book Cloud Atlas, all movies are called Disney's. Like all movies are called Disney's in the future. And I feel like movie theaters were called like Disneyporiums or something like that. So like this is a dystopia that has already been envisioned by David Mitchell, which is Disney being in charge of all entertainment. And it's pretty terrifying. So that's how I feel about that. Mm. Neil, what do you think?
I think I worry most about little stuff, like what happens to Fox's TV stuff, which has been really good, you know, especially FX. You know, Dave talked about sort of the dulling of things. Disney, I don't know, Disney's TV division is as dull as they come. You know, I'm not super excited about one out of every three movies having a 20-minute Frozen short attached to it.
That's unfair.
That's a joke. Yeah, probably not the best thing, I would say. But we'll see. It's hard to know with such a huge corporation what parts get dulled and what parts get left alone. And
I mean, there's some things you could take as indicators. Like Disney wouldn't let Ridley Scott make Alien Covenant.
Maybe.
Almost for sure. I mean, they might be like, hey, Ridley Scott, but he would have been like, I'm actually more interested in androids. And they would have been like, yes, please. Don't have anything burst out of anybody's back. That's not Disney.
That's so interesting because, like, you really think that Disney wants to acquire 20th Century Fox to make it Disney? Like, I feel like there was a time, like, didn't Touchstone used to do R-rated mm-hmm. films?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like there is a world in which Disney acquires Fox and then Fox becomes a place where we could still get Deadpool. Like, Deadpool doesn't have to be Disneyfied just because it's owned by Disney, you know?
I think, but I mean, it's not... If they're able to shelter any one of those things, they're able to shelter it, because I think like the thrust, like we've seen with like Pixar and the Muppets, is the things that are most broadly appealable, they're going to genericize to make them the most broadly appealable. So if we get a Deadpool, that's only because somebody protected Deadpool along the way. Like, I don't think there's a way to like shelter things like the Alien franchise. Like, that thing makes money, so it's gonna go.
I just feel like the brands that they acquired before Fox, like Pixar and Marvel, were already sort of quite wholesome brands, and so we don't know what it looks like when Disney acquires a less wholesome brand. We don't know that they will like, and what, you know, what Marvel says and what Pixar says is that when Disney acquired them, Disney said, we're not interested in changing what works for you, right?
Yeah, but they said the same thing when they bought Weinstein, whatever, the Miramax. They don't have like a history of following through with that because it's a large bureaucratic corporation.
Wait, they do have a history of following through with that with Marvel and Pixar. If it ain't broke, why fix it? I don't think you can put whatever happened with Miramax and the Weinstein Company like at the feet of Disney. I don't think that that's what we should do with
not the sexual harassment thing, but with the fact they bought it and they forced, you know, Harvey sort of like out because they just started controlling the actual... And anyway, not important. Nobody knows. There's a lot of weird things. We're all going to be forced into it.
As long as they don't mess up Fox Searchlight, I think I'll be okay.
Poor Neil asked for quick thoughts, and we're like, well, we have slow thoughts on this.
Listen, you listened to last week's pod. I know where this was headed. That's all I have for my segment this week.
All right, then let's, without any further ado, move into the oeuvre of Mr. Rian Johnson. I guess let's start at the top with Brick. It was a Focus feature film that came out in 2005. It is the neo-noir high school movie, as I was first introduced to it, and stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who's trying to solve a mystery using the lingo of Dashiell Hammett detective novels. let's start with Neil. Neil,
mm-hmm.
Brick, if you were to rate it on the Rian Johnson scale,
ooh,
one, two, or three.
I remember seeing Brick. Brick holds a special place for me sort of in my career as a person who writes about movies, because it was one of the first movies that I went to a film festival and saw and was able to write about early and kind of got in on the early side of, which is a big deal in our industry. So I have a sweet spot for Brick. Also, it's just a fascinating film. It's got what it showed us about a young Rian Johnson is his ability to create atmosphere, his ability to sort of press forward with strong ideas in a sense that, so like when Brick opens, there's no voiceover, there's no explanation of the world necessarily. It's just this sort of bell-driven haunting score done by Ryan's brother Nathan. And it's just showing us a lot of things that we don't understand until much later in the film. So it's a very bold thing to kick off your first movie, your first feature film, in a very show not tell way. I feel like we very rarely see that. And, you know, it's got compelling performances across the board. It's got a very unique style. He cut that thing on a MacBook, like on his own. And it's just, it's hard for me to think about other debuts in sort of the modern era that were just this polished, considering they were working with, you know, like if you look at the list of executive producers, it's like Rian Johnson's parents are the executive producers of that movie. So, yeah, I love Brick. Brick is Brick's up there for me. It's a super cool movie.
Way to not actually rank it, right?
Oh man, we have to rank things.
I just thought that would weigh into it. Apparently not. Apparently we don't have to do anything.
I think Brick's probably on top for me still.
It'll be interesting to see, like, as we talk about movies, if Neil's like, you know what, now that we're talking about Brothers Bloom, maybe it's number one. You know what, now that we're talking about Looper, it's number one.
This probably spoils it a little bit, but I think Brick is his most raw, sort of pure film. And obviously I think Brothers Bloom is the most charming and Looper is the most polished. So they're all on top of different lists. But I think if I were to pick one, like if I was going to walk up to somebody and say, you need to understand where Rian Johnson sort of came from, I would start them with Brick.
Well, yeah, for came from.
Or like,
start with his first film to find out where he came from.
But even if you just want to get a sense of his style as a filmmaker, even now, Brick is still the perfect place to start.
Salient point, Joanna.
I agree. Well, can I? Well, actually, one thing that Neil said,
sure.
Just really quickly, that he called Nathan Johnson Ryan's brother. He's actually his cousin. Yeah.
I always get that wrong.
But he has a brother who's also a musician, Aaron Johnson. Not Aaron, Taylor Johnson. Anyway, going back.
That would be funny.
I put Brick as my number two. And I think I saw Brick not at a film festival, so I was not, into Rian Johnson before anyone else, Rian like Johnson, Neil.
Hipster.
But I saw it very, I was really excited about it, and I saw it very early, early enough at an art house theater in San Francisco that they had like these little glossary booklets that they gave out with the, because there's this like noir slang, or it's not even noir slang, it's like just made up slang for the movie. And so they gave out these little glossary booklets, I remember, and I was like, oh, my pretentious 20 something ass is here for this movie. I love it. And, you know, looking back at it, I think that it is an astonishingly great first movie. As you know, as Neil said, it was cut on a MacBook. Like it's just incredible what he did with so little. Right. And it shows really clear vision and all this sort of stuff. But it's number two for me because it really does read as a first movie. Like this is a first movie and a very ambitious and good one. But like some people just have one good movie in them and it goes downhill. And I think Ryan sort of like perfected, and then maybe, well, we'll talk about what comes later. But, and I do disagree, respectfully with Neil that, Brick is his most pure. Cause I think the next one we're going to talk about is actually his most personal. And so for that, like Brick is a clever film that probably thinks it's a little cleverer than it actually is, but it's still a clever film. But there are just sort of layers of cute cleverness in there that I think obscures a lot of the emotion, whereas with one of his other films, I just get more of an emotional hit from it. This was part of, not the beginning of, because I think Mysterious Skin came before it, but like, you know, Brick is very responsible for the adulthood surge of Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And Nathan's score on that film and on all of Ryan's films like cannot be underestimated. Like we're doing this great exercise where we're talking about these three films and maybe a little bit of the TV that Ryan's done. And that's always really fun to do, to watch all this stuff and then go see The Last Jedi next week or whatever. And be thinking about like, oh, that reminds me of this part of this movie. You know, if it's all fresh in your brain, it's really fun to do that, I think. But it'll be so weird to see a Rian Johnson film without any of Nathan's music, I think. So, so those are my Brick thoughts.
I am going to chime in, I guess, closer to Neil, but still, oh man, is it going to be my number one? Let me start talking and come to that at the end.
You're the one who wanted to rank them.
I know. I see. I like causing some conflict for furthering discussion. Brick is really an exercise in control that's astonishing, and that's what I respond to it for as a first film. I think it works really well the first watch in terms of easing you into the language, Clockwork Orange-like, before any of the plot points really have to stick. And the nice part about doing that while also having fun with the tone and the setting is that on a rewatch, when you know all the twists, the movie is consistently funny until it turns very, very dramatic. So it doesn't give you a spot where the plot or the performances are thin enough that the artifice of what he's trying to do, putting Dashiell Hammett language in high school, ever feels... like, it feels jokey when it should, and then it feels deadly serious at the end when it needs to kind of close out its twist. And in making that transition, it doesn't have a thin moment where it breaks its own spell. And being able to do that and being able to rewatch this movie and look at every performer having to sell something that they're assuming on faith is going to work within the context of the film is really masterful. For a first feature and for any feature overall. And I think the way that Rian Johnson introduces us to how he tells stories through visual editing really helps the other movies be more coherent on your first watch if you start with Brick.
I agree.
Go ahead.
Sorry. No, go ahead.
I'm going to say number two. Number two at the end of my speech. I'm going to put Brick number two.
I agree with both of you that it is where people probably should start. Like, if they have the bandwidth for two movies, why not start with Brick? You know, like, we're not asking you to watch 100 movies. We're asking you to maybe watch three. If you can only watch two, I'd still say start with Brick, but then go to Brothers Bloom next. And I also want to echo what Dave said about the visual style, which I don't think I talked about. Like, there's a lot of really creative, fun shots in Brick. Like, and like the poster image is so alluring, which is just, you know, a girl's wrist and a bracelet, which is also a very tremendous shot from the film. Or there's that like car scene in the parking lot, you know what I mean? Where you're like hearing the car and seeing it, and it's like so upsetting because of the way it's shot. And, you know, so for a first time director to really put his visual stamp out there so quickly, which I think continues in his TV work and in his next film, and then maybe got a little lost in that third film, which we will talk about.
Maybe we should have structured this instead of chronologically, because we're going to get to Looper and have lots of stuff to say. But before that, let's pivot to Brothers Bloom, and let's start with Dearest Joanna, because I know this is her number one, because it's not Looper. So, Joanna,
number one, yeah.
What makes you love Brothers Bloom?
Well, like I said, I think that Brothers Bloom is his most personal one, which I like was confirmed this week, because I was tweeting about us doing this Ryan episode, and someone on Twitter responded to me about, and I tagged Ryan in it, and someone on Twitter responded, you know, that movie is really personal to me because of my relationship with my brother. And I feel like it's kind of the same way for Ryan. And Ryan liked that tweet. So I feel like that's confirmation that this is his most personal film. It's not just about this relationship with brothers, which is so important and interesting to me, but it's also this idea of Mark Ruffalo's character as this like storyteller. And whenever you have a filmmaker and a writer making a movie about, I mean, he's a con man, but he's also a storyteller and he's also crafting these narratives. And so like Mark Ruffalo is the clear stand-in for the author in that context. Right. And so his exploration of that, of like, what motivates Mark Ruffalo's character, like the compulsive nature of the storytelling, the intricate detailing of the storytelling, and then also the like the sacrifice and tragedy of the storytelling, which maybe is a little like grandiose. Like I will maybe not spoil the end of Brothers Bloom, I don't know, but like, you know, the, you know, basically the art and storytelling and love for his brother are the most important things to that character, played so well by Mark Ruffalo. Adrian Brody also, like, that's my favorite Adrian Brody performance. Sorry, The Pianist. you know, Riku Kikuchi as Bang Bang, Rachel Weisz. Everyone, I think, is just really amazing. That film was very stylish. And, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine who may or may not be listening to this podcast. Hello, Taylor, if you are, about, like, the Ryan verse and what we think of his thing. And what I would say about both Brick and Brothers Bloom is it's Ryan plussing a genre. So like, okay, what if you took noir but you made it teens, but not in like a super dumb way, like still like interacting with noir tropes, but like sort of plussing that genre take. And the you know, Brothers Bloom is like, what if you took The Sting, turn it up to 9,000? That's what the Brothers Bloom is. It's not a perfect film. It's a little shaggy. There's like maybe a few too many double crosses. But I think the emotional authenticity of it is what really makes that film stick for me. So Brothers Bloom, number one.
Neil, Brothers Bloom.
Oh, Brothers Bloom is delightful. and I think, you know, from a career trajectory standpoint, it was really interesting to see him get so light. And the thing about Ryan Johnson is he's a very meticulous filmmaker. And I think Joanna touched on that, where that's what makes Brothers Bloom also kind of personal, because it's all about this sort of meticulous nature of storytelling. So he's a very detail-oriented filmmaker, and it was interesting to see him go from something so specific and tight as Brick. And, you know, Brick is funny, sure, at times, but it's also, you know, a fairly dark movie about a high school drug ring and murder and Joseph Gordon-Levitt getting the shit kicked out of him at all times. But there's just endless smiles to be had with Brothers Bloom. It is just a happy movie, even though it is dealing with, you know, con men and these emotions of, you know, the relationship between the two brothers. There's some serious stuff in there, but it's just delightful, and has a completely different rhythm, which I think is very interesting from, you know, a filmmaker then on his second film to essentially walk to a slightly different beat so effortlessly. And I think that, you know, goes to his talents both as a writer and as a director. You know, I think the thing that we gloss over is the fact that he wrote both of these two movies, and they're both extremely well written. And I think what we see in his TV work later is that he can come in and direct someone else's script, you know, perfectly. But he's a really good writer, which I think bodes well for, I guess, his future as the maester of a Star Wars trilogy.
With a king of a whole unknown region or something.
Right.
The maester.
I also really like Brothers Bloom. For me, it really stands out and is probably going to hit my number one spot, because unlike other Rian Johnson movie, the two other Rian Johnson movies, this one isn't obviously not in our world. This one has to be ushered out of our world and into the Rian Johnson world. So there's things on the sides, like Bang Bang has a cell phone, and it hints that, you know, we're on the East Coast at this ungodly huge mansion, but we're still in New Jersey. So, like, the idea that even though all the settings that we go to, even, like, the climax in Russia, all of these are grand places that I don't feel actually exist in the real world, they have to sort of migrate us into the story that way. So it starts with the rhyme to sort of set you off, and then everything's heightened. Really early on, there's a camel that escapes that drinks expensive whiskey.
It's my new favorite camel.
Yep, that's the level that this movie has to bring you to.
My friends and I, after we saw Brothers Bloom the first time, my friends and I would always quote, because Mark Ruffalo like stumbles into that scene drunker than he is like a second later. I don't know why, but he stumbles the scene and he slurs, "This isn't the bathrooms, this is camels." It's like, what? Oh, so good. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, and I think that although the characters for me don't exist as much outside of the central two, I think the movie does a really good job at making that essential. Like, if I had more of an idea of Penelope, then Penelope wouldn't be as cool as just living out everything on her surface. And if I had more of an idea of who Bang Bang was, she wouldn't be able to come and go from the story and make it more delightful in the way that she is. So it's a real idea of like character economy, or character in service of a story, or all characters in service of a story. And like Joanna was talking about, this one really wraps up both. It could be about like family. It's also slightly about, can feel like a director, you know, writing these characters and then slightly losing control of them, but having to nudge them against his better will towards an end. There's a lot of cool layers that you could take Brothers Bloom on, or you could just be delighted to it from moment to moment. But I really like how he carries over his, I guess, visual editing style from Brick to here. We can speed over a lot of plot or time by only seeing key moments. I think Penelope showing off all of her talents is like a very obvious way to do that. But then also how we're cutting around them making a plan and then talking within the plan. So we're always never sure at what level of the con we're existing at as an audience, is very purposeful. And it is artfully juggled enough that even if you know what parts are a con and what parts aren't, the performances sustain you by the time you get to that part. I'm trying to not spoil Brothers Bloom, but
I've heard some criticism from some people about Ryan's like writing women, like whether or not he can write women well. And like I see that with Brick a bit, because Brick is like a very stereotypical noir in that you have like a femme fatale and the more innocent girl is like the victim, and you know, stuff like that. And I don't. you know, that when I first saw it, I really liked the femme fatale in Brick played by Nora Zehetner, Laura. I thought it was great. And rewatching it, I don't like it very much. But even though she doesn't have lines, I really love the Bang Bang character. And I love the Penelope character because usually in this film, she's the dupe, right? And she's never really behind.
She's the one who's constantly pointing out the fact.
She always knows what's going on, and she's still like happily along for the ride. And there's that great scene, where she's doing the card trick and like talking about her childhood that just communicates, I think, so much depth to that character and loneliness and all this sort of stuff, that she's not just like the quirky manic pixie dream girl. She's like this real weirdo, you know, and not in like a just in service of the hero kind of way. And so, you know, I think, you know, we can talk about whatever's going on with Emily Blunt and Looper, but I think that, you know, Brothers Bloom really does get its female characters right.
So. Yeah, I didn't mean to say they weren't complete in the sense that they weren't like enjoyable or all there. In terms of they don't have to change for the plot to go forward.
Yeah, yeah,
They show up. Oh, sorry. Just clarifying. I didn't want to.
No, I wasn't really
the women.
Yeah, I wasn't really. I wasn't responding to. I'm not that. I'm always responding to you, but I wasn't like trying to be like you're wrong. I was really this. This is really other. Other conversations I've had, but yeah. So Brothers Bloom. Oh, my other question about Brothers Bloom is this, which I love. I love it from start to finish. And I really love the start. And that's a great little bit of poetry that starts off the Brothers Bloom. But are you allowed to have Ricky Jay narrate the beginning of your movie when Ricky Jay already narrated the beginning of Magnolia? Like, are you allowed to do that? I don't know if that's allowed. So that's all.
I mean, he did it, so I guess.
Yeah, but like, it feels like not okay. I don't know. I love it, but it's, you know.
I also love, what's his name? The Frenchman.
Wow, Hagrid?
Yeah.
Robbie Coltrane.
Robbie Coltrane.
Yeah.
Robbie Coltrane is just great. It's just, you know, and I think even with Looper, which we're about to transition to talking about, one of the things that stands out to me about the three films is that Rian Johnson puts a lot of effort and thought into the way he builds the worlds of his movies. And I think that that's an important thing to know, to kind of take away from his style sort of as a filmmaker, is that he's very good at world building in very quick sort of efficient ways, which is something I would probably say that I enjoyed the most about Looper. I'm curious to hear y'all's takes on Looper because it doesn't sound like we have a consensus of everybody liking it. But I liked it for that reason. I also enjoy Joe Gordon-Levitt pretty much at all times. But I can see where maybe it's not everybody's top movie. But it, you know what? It's a bold, interesting vision of, like, he tries to do a lot of really interesting story things in Looper, and some of them work, some of them don't. And then, you know, same thing with the visuals. Some of them work really well and some of them don't.
Are we talking about Looper now?
We are talking. I'm transitioning us into Looper.
All right.
So I guess I'm curious to hear what you guys think of Looper.
His feature. I'm not great at math, but I believe Looper is number three for all of us. And here's what, you know, this should come as no surprise to anyone who has heard me talk about Rogue One or a lot of other things. I get hung up on certain bad decisions. The makeup on Joe Gordon-Levitt is a challenge for Looper. It was a bad idea. And I also think it's a bad idea.
How else would you know that was his loop?
I also think it's a bad idea to cast Bruce Willis in this movie when he's already made 12 Monkeys. I think that's a bad idea too. Which is about a guy going back on his own timeline. So, and like the things that I talked about with Brothers Bloom and Brick about plussing a genre thing, I'm not sure that Looper does plus any kind of time traveling you know, Terminator or any of that, you know, like I'm not sure it adds anything to that. I also don't think a lot of Ryan's signature visuals like made it into this movie. And I don't know why there aren't like, there's like that. No, there aren't like great shot there. The marquee moment for this film is when the kid who's played by, hold on, give me a second. The same kid who was in Twin Peaks, and he's really great. And he has this sort of like reveal of like his powers or whatever. That's a terrifying, wonderful, fantastic moment. But other than that, it's Pierce Gagnon is the name of the kid, or Gagnon, but probably Gagnon. Other than that, I can't think of a single shot of Looper where I'm just like, ooh, you know. I also don't feel Looper on any level. I don't feel like the emotional ennui or pain of like having to, you know, close your own loop or any of these things. I just don't feel it. And I don't know what went wrong. I was so looking forward to this because I was like, Brick was great. Bob's Boom was even better. Oh, Looper, I can't wait. The character design of Joseph Gordon-Levitt does not look good to me, but I'm sure it's going to be great. And then I was like, I was left really cold by it. So yeah, I'm here for Dave's opinion on Looper.
I like Looper a lot, but in trying to, I guess, write and concoct a time travel movie that is predicated on the idea that it's going to work within itself, everything that slows Looper down is a result of that choice. So there's a reason that the time travel movies you like have something that makes them illogical. That's because movies work better that way. This one gets really close to having a system that would be fun to play around with. What happens to Paul Dano's character, both in the future and the past, and is terrifying. The I think split to a different timeline to introduce Bruce Willis's character is great. I think you know, the idea of closing your loop is great, and then Bruce Willis gets away from his own loop. That's all still good. And then we just screech to a stop with this Rainmaker thing. And it exists as in the plot to provide us with the finale sequence and like a way out of this perfectly constructed world that makes it all work, and that you're seeing, you know, actual timeline change and whatnot. And then, you know, we've also had previous scenes to show that that's possible, and what, and building this world slows this movie down to a point where it's hard to emotionally connect to anybody. It's more about where they are instead of, and what they're, no, it's more about where they are and what they're saying instead of what they're doing and who they are, which makes it all sort of crumble. So it's a really well-built puzzle, but it's a puzzle of a really bland picture. There are moments I dig, but they're all the narrative loops that make those moments possible. They're not necessarily executed to the level that would make like a classic movie. Like I don't know if anyone's gonna top Back to the Future in terms of entertaining and time travel, but they're not going to do it by committing to people thinking that they want their time travel to be perfect in movies. That's like assuming that, you know, because you killed so many people in Metropolis, you need to start your next movie with why Batman found that traumatic. It's not taking the correct lesson from complaints about that genre of movie.
So right. You'd almost say that it's too meticulous.
Oh, for sure. And I think it'd make an interesting short story where that we could maybe spend time learning about the characters without having to pile on all the shit that a movie does, where if it's, you're seeing another timeline and you're going to have to see what that character is. Like, we could just spend more time in whatever the fuck they're thinking about when they're on that farm for so long. Maybe I'd have a better understanding of the stakes and what's going on. But instead, it's all been reduced to flags along this plot that's marching towards its inevitable ending, because that's the loop. And so, like, it makes it a tough watch its first time through and straight up tedious any additional time you go through it.
It's almost like the, you know, Looper is the sophomore slump movie that he didn't make with Brothers Bloom.
Right. Where
it's that it's a very, you know, detail oriented filmmaker who gets a larger budget and kind of goes a, you know, couple steps too far.
I love this idea of it being a short story. I think it would be such a good short story. I'm sure it was the short story that Ryan wrote first. And then it just doesn't like bear up under feature length. That's true of so many great like sci-fi short stories. But, you know, and also with a short story, you don't have to deal with the makeup on Joseph Gordon-Levitt's face, which looks terrible. So,
I mean, it has a good Philip K. Dick ring to it, but the reason those things like have internal logic is because you're not seeing them. Your imagination is pasting over those holes.
Right.
Instead, this movie pastes over those holes for you, which is great, but it's a patchwork quilt of a movie. So, I mean, I'm going to say A+ for effort. I'm sure it is rated. I'm not going to say it's overrated or underrated. I think Looper is exactly rated in terms of its reputation, because I went back and looked at the Rotten Tomatoes and everyone's like, this is good. A little dry, but you know, it does, it concludes its thesis, which I guess is like the point of a thing. I don't know if it's worth, I will say this, in the rewatch to do this episode, I bought 2 Rian Johnson movies and I rented 1 Rian Johnson movie.
Right. Something that we should talk about in terms of the Rianverse, or whatever we want to call it, is his repeated use of actors, right? So Joseph Gordon-Levitt is technically in all 3 of these films. He's got like a very short cameo in Brothers Bloom, but he's in there. Like half the cast of Brick is in this one party scene in Brothers Bloom, which is really fun. Noah Sagan, who plays character Kid Blue in Looper, who I quite like, is also in all 3 films, and one of the episodes of Breaking Bad that Ryan directed, Ozymandias. So look for a Noah Sagan cameo in The Last Jedi is what I would say.
Also look for Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
I know.
We know he's in The Last Jedi, but I don't think... I think it's going to be hard to recognize him.
You think he's a trooper?
Well, they've dropped a whole bunch of... I think the princes are troopers.
Right.
I don't know. I think JGL might have gotten the alien treatment. But
fun.
We'll see.
Like
Little Gary. All right. We should move over.
Really quickly, I don't think we can finish talking about the Rianverse without talking about his 3 episodes of Breaking Bad, which are 3 of the greatest episodes of Breaking Bad ever were, Fly, 51, and Ozymandias. Ozymandias is one of the best episodes of television ever. Fly is one of the best examples of a bottle episode ever. I mean, this is what I'm talking about in terms of like plussing things, right? Ryan takes the bottle episode, which is a known thing, and he's like, yeah, but what if I made the best one? And that's what Fly is, right? And Ozymandias, which is, I think most people agree, the best episode of Breaking Bad there is. And if you want to hear more of Ryan and my thoughts on Ozymandias, he actually recorded a commentary track for the episode with Dave Chen and myself when we had a Breaking Bad. And that's the other thing that if you're listening to this and you don't know this about Rian Johnson, one thing you should know about Rian Johnson is he is like beloved of the film nerd community because he has just given so much to the film nerd community, like as he was starting out. And he still does. He still interacts. He's like this big ass shut fucking director now. He still interacts with all the film bloggers who like supported him when he started out. I don't know if you guys saw on his like Last Jedi press day, what he put on his Instagram was like photos of all the journalists who were interviewing him, which is just really charming.
Entire tour.
Yeah, it's just really charming. Like he's like, hey, you guys are part of this. And like you would, there's some people who might do it where you think that's disingenuous. That's just like sucking up to the press.
But it's
so genuine with Rian Johnson. So you can listen to old episodes of Slash Filmcast and hear Rian Johnson play the freaking banjo on an episode of Slash Filmcast.
And Rian Johnson frustrating Dave Chen is my favorite Rian Johnson.
So fun. He loves
he
making
is
fun
one
of Dave
the great
Chen.
Dave Chen foils of all
it's
time.
So good. So yeah. So please listen if you have the time. Watch Ozymandias and listen to me be really nervous and make really stupid jokes. And then Ryan make fun of Dave Chen as we watch an episode of an all-time classic episode of Breaking Bad. You can just Google that, like, Breaking Bad commentary, Ozymandias, Ryan Johnson. And the last thing I'll say about that, and like in case there's anything else you guys want to say, is that I think you guys may have both already touched on this a little bit, but I do think his talent as a TV director for Breaking Bad and also this great show, FX show Terriers, which I loved, is what makes him so well suited for the Star Wars universe. You know, Lucasfilm obviously has had some issues with some of its directors, and there are zero complaints about Ryan because Ryan knows how to work his vision alongside someone else's vision. That's what you have to do as a TV director. You come in, someone else is the showrunner, someone else has written the episode. It's your job to execute that and hopefully add flair to it, but to execute that. Ryan wrote this new Star Wars film, but him working inside the machinery of Lucasfilm surprises me so little. He's so affable. He knows when to back off, and he knows when to sort of like exert his vision. And I'm just really, if this is a good movie, which I have no reason to suspect it's not, I think it's just the greatest idea that he's directing another trilogy of films, if that's what he wants to do for the rest of his life. And that's what makes like some of the best Marvel directors so good, like the Russo brothers. They're TV directors, so they can direct inside a larger franchise because they're TV directors. So those are my Ryan and TV thoughts. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on that.
I think you made the best point.
Yeah, I don't have anything to to add.
Which
to
is
that.
Like when you look at his Breaking Bad episodes, they don't feel out of place. But you can tell that this was one of the Ryan Johnson episodes. Like when you watch Fly, you can tell that someone with a sort of next level talent, especially visually in Fly, is operating here. But it doesn't feel like a departure, which I think is super important when you talk about especially what they're trying to do with Star Wars now. And I think, you know, maybe that is, you know, even J.J. Abrams has that sort of pedigree of living in TV world, but JJ is more of a top line control guy. He's the showrunner, but so it'll be interesting to see how Ryan Johnson's style sort of comes through while still existing in a world built by JJ Abrams.
No. And then it'll go back to JJ Abrams. Like, we will be back to the show after this break. And we're back. We're going to talk about The Last Jedi a little bit. I'm going to let Joanna be the arbiter of spoilage.
Oh, God.
Because she's made the choice, as you're all open to make, to limit her amount of spoiler knowledge in the run-up to The Last Jedi.
Just limit her amount of Dave spoilers. Like, that's a different level of spoiler.
I mean,
like, I'm watching the trailers. I'm not going patches. You know, I'm watching the trailers. I'm lightly reading interviews. But like the Dave knack of knowing everything that's going to happen in a film, which is something you're very good at. I don't want, for whatever reason, I've decided I don't want this film told to me by my dear, dear, lovely, smart friend, Dave Gonzalez.
Literally away from seeing it.
Yeah.
So here's the benefit to that.
I'm 2 days out, Dave, man. I can make it.
This week, I also did a Star Wars primer for everybody for the New York Times watching
Yay!
Section.
Congrats, Dave.
Which means
so
I have some practice on making it for everybody. That's why I'm going to hand it over to you. If you have non-spoilery Star Wars Last Jedi topics or questions, I would love a place to start.
Neil, start with Neil.
I'm just going to cough. I wrote in the notes, and I think this is a good place to go from where we were just talking. Like, what do we expect from The Last Jedi sort of from a Ryan Johnson context or based on that? And I think we've started to answer it by bringing up his Breaking Bad work. Is it I don't know. Was The Force Awakens funny?
Yes.
Yeah.
I feel like I haven't watched that movie in a long time.
BB-8 gives a thumbs up with a lighter.
I watched it last week. John Boyega is really funny in that movie.
I feel like there's a drier sense of humor to Rian Johnson.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Potentially come through. You know, I think when we look at Star Wars trilogies in general, right, the second one is often the darker one. The second one is the one that sort of sets up the big fight, you know, in the third movie, the big conflict, and is usually the one that delivers sort of the gut punch, you know, Luke, I am your father type of stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering how that'll balance with still making it light and adventure-y and super accessible Disney version, and have a bunch of porgs in it.
Well,
so I'm curious.
I know that Dave will have a better answer to this, but I just want to say really quickly that, like, I was thinking about that when I was doing this rewatch for this episode. And, you know, Ryan has said, I believe, that, like, Luke and Rey, like, the relationship between Luke and Rey is sort of the crux of this film. But we're also expecting, potentially, either through deceptive editing or not, I don't know, whatever, more Kylo and Rey relationship as well. And that made me think of the Brothers Bloom and just sort of, like, yeah, I am here for Rian Johnson digging in on a family saga. Yes. Assuming that at least some of these people are related to another. I know we know that Luke and Kylo are related, but, like, I am here for some of that messed up Brothers Bloom family dynamic to help inform what we might expect from The Last Jedi. I don't want any specifics on who's related to whom, and all of that. But Dave, like, you know, without diving into specifics, like, does that feel like that family dynamic, which is so crucial to Star Wars? But I don't know how much it's been deeply felt in Star Wars, until maybe The Force Awakens, you know, feels for you.
Yeah, I'm going to say what I'm hoping for is what you're hoping for, Joanna, but I think everyone's our family now. I think The Force Awakens was a large enough hit that even though we're going to see family dynamics across everyone, and we're going to feel every side of them. We're going to be on Kylo Ren's side, we're going to be on Rey's side, we're going to be on Luke's side, and we're going to be bouncing back and forth as to what that is.
Are we
like
going to be on Snoke's side?
It depends what you like in the universe and galaxy, Neil.
I have another hope. It's all about Brothers Bloom for me, right? We know that, like, outside of the family saga, there is a side quest adventure with John Boyega's character and Kelly Marie Tran's character, Rose, who's a new character. And, you know, I think what we know about Rose so far, you know, she's a mechanic. There's, like, please don't tell me. Her sister's, like, missing or dead or something like that. And it's like a rescue mission or it's a something mission. They have a quest. They're on a mission. We've already seen John Boyega be very funny and charming in The Force Awakens, I think. Like, rewatching, I'm like, he is kind of, he and BB-8 are the comic relief, to be honest with you. But the photos we've seen of Finn and Rose look like screwball comedy adventure. I'm not saying it's gonna be that wacky, but, like, Brothers Bloom, sort of like old screwball comedy, like romantic screwball comedy bantering, whether or not it's actually technically romantic, like that, I'm excited for. Dave, what is your reaction to that?
Oh, yeah, all of this is like, I really want The Last Jedi to be a Rian Johnson movie like you're describing. I'd love it to be Star Wars Brothers Bloom. What I'm wondering is how much that TV instinct's going to kick in and parts of it are going to be Star Wars. We already know from his Twitter account it has the most wipes of any Star Wars movie. So there's something that Rian Johnson didn't usually do, but then once he decided to do, he's doing the most of. Like, this might be the most Star Wars, but part of that is going to take away what I like from Rian Johnson. I would love if there was part of this movie that was edited to not feel like an adventure serial. Like, if we covered a whole bunch of plot, like a training montage or something in the Rian Johnson style and didn't have to put up with space opera style. That I would love, but I'm not sure if the boundaries of what Star Wars has to be includes that. I'm very interested to hear how the score works out within those same bounds. But what I'm most excited about in terms of Rian Johnson-ness carrying over to Star Wars is there hasn't been a lot of behind-the-scenes drama about anybody else doing anything to this script. Everything we've heard about changes to the script is stuff that Rian Johnson said himself. Neil, you were worried about the humor. We know one sample joke because it was cut for continuity purposes, but someone, or Captain Phasma at one point said, I was in that garbage chute for a month, and the response was, what did you eat? And that was the idea of a joke. It had to get cut because obviously Starkiller Base got blown up, so there's no way she could be there for a week. But that's the idea of the Rian Johnson level of humor. My hope is that it's a lot like Brick, where it's fun Star Wars action, humor, lightness, until the end when it turns and it's suddenly not. But it can't, you know, break that illusion either way. You know, the Porgs can be funny and they're in the same place with Luke Skywalker, but if Luke Skywalker slips on a wet rock and falls down and hits his head, that breaks the movie. So it's the same sort of balancing act in terms of tone. I'm very happy about it because if anything, well, rediscussing these past three Rian Johnson movies has reinforced is that he doesn't make missteps. Even things that we would
except view as for the makeup on Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Even things that we may not like are things that he's committed to completely within the movie.
Okay, sure, yeah.
Well, and he's also got a much better makeup team.
Because that's true.
I wanted to ask you about Laura Dern's character. Have you read the Leia book that came out?
Yes, I have.
Okay, so I don't consider this a spoiler because it's like canon. It's pre-information, not a spoiler. But I read some like recaps of it and stuff like that. I haven't read the book itself, but I am fascinated by this character that Laura Dern will be playing. Not just because we love Laura Dern, but let me just run up briefly what I know, which is that like she's potentially bi. Fun. When she was young, she was super weird. The comparison a lot of people made is to Luna Lovegood in the Harry Potter series, that she would like speak in riddles. She and Leia were like super good friends. Leia didn't like really like or get her at first, and then they became super good friends because like she's super weird, but like Luna, like she's got a sharpness about her. She sees things that people don't. I don't imagine that Laura Dern is going to show up speaking in weirdo riddles, but you know, we've seen more of her than we've seen of Benicio del Toro, but we've seen very little of her in the trailers. We've seen images of her. We know she's Poe's boss. We know she has a different managerial style than Leia. We know Poe doesn't really like that very much. But like, is Laura Dern going to be a super duper weirdo in this movie or what, Dave?
Is she going to be a super duper weirdo? Fun things about Admiral Holdo that are not in the movie but are in the book, and it sounds like you would love to learn, is her particular culture has like a meditation ritual that is essentially like what do you call that? Sky dancing, where the women roll themselves up in the women or men in like fabrics and do like twirls and drops that but stay suspended the whole time.
Oh, okay.
And so that's what they do in like to let off steam and to help themselves think. And so
like you do, yeah.
That's
yeah.
How her and Leia sort of like bond is through this like sky dancing thing. She's super weird. The hair color and the way she dresses is sort of like her expressionary tactics. They change very often. That's sort of what is Luna Lovegoody about it. You're right in that she does speak in sort of riddles, but they're not riddles as much as she assumes everybody's at the same thought process level that she is. So very often she'll mention something not everybody's thinking about or jump a few steps ahead, which is probably what's allowed her to become a vice admiral in the Resistance, which is where we meet her in the movie. I don't want to talk too much about what she does in the movie and how she comes off because that involves things we can't talk about. But it is very likely that this is the weirdest Star Wars character we've seen.
Yeah, yes.
That isn't
like
an
alien. Isn't that so fun? I'm so excited.
I'm for it.
Neil, do you have any questions? Ooh, Neil, ask a Porg question.
I mean, I'm pro porgs.
Yeah.
I don't know if I have too many porg related questions.
Dave, are the porgs going to be just cute, or are they going to be like too much and annoying?
I imagine they're going to ride that line for a lot of people.
Okay.
A la the Ewoks. They have
is
a lot
there
more
a story thing comedy behind the porgs.
You mean
this
like
is, you could simple yes or no? Like, do they have a part to play in the story, or are they just there?
You're talking about like plot wise?
Yeah.
Not that super important.
Cool. I'm okay with that. I don't need porgs being like central to the you know, Skywalker
they weren't like the first Jedi
arc
or anything like that. We're not gonna
they're porgs from the book.
Ewoks aren't a bad analogy, except I don't think they're going to be as integral to the plot as even the Ewoks were. But in terms of how they can be used as like side characters, like Star Wars has creatures and we're not on a desert planet. We should make some use of that. Finally, we're not on a goddamn desert planet.
So what you're saying is there's not going to be a porg uprising in the third film.
I can't say that for sure.
Dave, this is yes. fun. This is a really fun game. Dave, what do you think of the fact that when I talked to Christian Louboutin about Star Wars shoes, he called Rey a Jedi? Do you think that's just Christian Louboutin not really understanding the difference between being a Force user and a Jedi? Or do you think that Rey is or will eventually become a Jedi?
That's an interesting question, Joanna. I'm going to answer that question with a question for you to revisit.
Okay.
Something that you've reported on Star Wars before.
Lightsabers?
There's recently been talk of a, quote, new hue, unquote, for a lightsaber. Would that have any significance to the question you're asking?
Well, okay. So there's a question of whether or not, I feel like we can talk about this. There's a question of whether or not that Rey has, are you talking about the white lightsaber?
All I know is that we're for sure had a new hue hint, but the question would be, is it new or is it just to this series? So people are debating whether Rey's going to get a white lightsaber or Luke actually has his green lightsaber, despite all the deferring that's not actually in the movie.
Okay, so Pablo Hidalgo told me that that they don't lose lightsabers. So, like, that Pablo Hidalgo, who's, like, the holder of the stories at Lucasfilm. So, like, that to me says the green lightsaber is coming back eventually. That was his answer to me. We don't lose track of lightsabers is what he said. And then the other thing he said, though, but didn't he say to me that the color of a lightsaber doesn't – oh, are you talking about kyber crystals? Because I don't know that I'm prepared to talk about kyber crystals right now.
Well, I just think it's interesting because you got more evidence to either side of this argument than has been presented in arguments that I've seen. So I want to refresh everybody's mind what he said to you about lightsaber colors.
Okay, I'm going to Google it while you guys
It's an interesting thing about how it used to work is that lightsabers would be dyed red by Siths by making them bleed, and so that's why the Sith had red lightsabers. Then after they had to change Luke's new lightsaber to green so they could shoot it against the blue sky at the beginning of Return of the Jedi, the story adapted to young Padawans go to Ilium to get their own kyber crystal and build their own lightsaber, and that has some sort of influence on the color, and Jedi started having different color lightsabers that weren't red. Red was still reserved for the Sith, who may or may not had bleeding kyber crystals. And then Ahsoka Tano, former Padawan of Darth Vader, left the Jedi Order and came across two white lightsabers because she is not a Jedi. She's something else in between.
Okay, so if Rey has a white Jedi, then maybe she's not a Jedi, something else in between. This is what Pablo Hidalgo said to me. I'm basically going to repeat what Dave just said. George Lucas's rule of thumb was that bad guys get red, good guys get blue, or eventually green. And then Sam Jackson wanted a purple one, and that's how he got a purple one.
I love that tangent. Where it's just like Sam Jackson just wanted a purple one.
Yeah, he wanted to see himself in the big group fights, so they gave him a purple lightsaber.
But Hidalgo also, like, cautioned against the notion that the color of a lightsaber blade is indicative of morals or character, like the Sorting Hat in the Harry Potter world or anything like that. And then asking about, like, whether the lightsaber belongs to her, he says, in general, a lightsaber belongs to the person who constructed it. In The Force Awakens, Maz says the saber is calling to Rey now, whether or not it's literally calling to her because to become hers, or it's calling to her because she knows it will be taken back to Luke. We'll see. And then the last thing he said is that we take to heart the lesson that Obi-Wan tried to impart to Anakin. This weapon is your life. We're not one to lose track of lightsabers, about the green lightsaber. So that's exciting to, you know, this is a rumor that we've heard for a while now, the three of us, that a white lightsaber was potentially coming to.
Wait, what color was Obi-Wan's lightsaber?
It was blue.
Blue, yeah.
So is the one Rey has in the trailer, is that his?
No, that's lightsaber that's one, Luke's first lightsaber slash Anakin's lightsaber.
Oh.
So, like, Anakin had a lightsaber, then Obi-Wan gave it to Luke, and then Luke had it, and then Luke built his own lightsaber, which was green for editing reasons, but that's neither here nor there. And so,
well,
this,
the blue lightsaber got sent down a Cloud City
right
trash
with
hole,
a hand,
and then
blah,
somehow
blah.
Ended up in space.
So the lightsaber that she found in Maz Kanata's was Anakin's, and then Luke's, and now she's bringing it back to Luke. How it got from the Cloud City hole to Maz Kanata's castle, we don't know. And also, what's going on with the green lightsaber, we don't know. Does Luke still have it? Are we going to see Luke and Rey training on the cliffs, him with the green saber, her with the blue? That would be really fun. Anyway. Yeah, lightsabers, porgs, Lord Dern,
yeah,
oh my.
Crystals.
2.5 hours. Dave, let's finish up maybe talking about the running time.
Sure.
Of The Last
it's
Jedi.
It's a long one.
Which is 2.5 hours. Ryan Johnson suggests you go to the bathroom before you see his film. Knowing what you know about the plot without revealing what the plot is to us,
mm-hmm.
Are there obvious sections of what you've heard about that you're like, man, they could have trimmed some of this fat? Like, I don't know, in a Pirates of the Caribbean movie where they like go to the island and leave the island, come back and go and come back, and you're like, there are three trips to that island he could have trimmed. Or do you feel like it's just going to be a whole lot of movie and we're going to have fun the whole time?
Right now, it looks like a whole lot of movie. A lot of that could change because there is, in terms of what we know, a big question mark in the goals of the Resistance besides exist. Once we figure out what that is, that'll sort of fill in, at least in my mind, what I'm would now say was like, I'm most worried about this movie at the back end, or like in the very middle of the movie, like it's an hour 30, hour 40 minutes in, that's when it needs to pivot into being about the climax. And right now, what we've heard about is going to be a lot like Empire Strikes Back, where they're all on like different sides. So it's really soupy and really up to the editing as to if that pace can keep up. There's a possibility that if we didn't learn the right things from Looper, there's a little part I'm worried about in this movie. But if we did learn the right things from Looper, and if we picked up enough Star Wars along the way, that will be that part that I'm now worried about will actually be as thrilling as it's supposed to be. Was that vague enough?
Yeah, loved it.
All right.
So you're saying it could be good.
You're saying there's a chance.
I've got really high hopes. All indicators are very good.
Are you cool. Trying to tell me right now that at some point Oscar Isaac is going to be in bad porg makeup? Just kidding. I don't know.
Oscar Isaac found out that Bruce Willis was really
porg,
him.
His Looper is a porg. and we, the last thing, okay, this is the last thing. The last thing we haven't talked about before we go is my secret favorite character from this franchise, which is not so secret, which is Donald Gleason's.
Okay.
No, Donald Gleason's General Hux. No, R2-D2 is a little asshole, as you have trained me to.
Will there be ventral cannons?
Yes.
And will someone need to be screamed at to fire them?
Will someone need to fire a ventral cannons? I Donald Gleason sort of implied that he might have a slightly larger part, but I feel like everyone does because there's like an extra hour of film. Can you give me any vague or exciting hints about my boy General Hux in this movie?
Sure. I will say
he's in it.
He made it off Starkiller Base. He's alive. Yes. He's in the movie.
He's in the movie. All right. Thank you.
Even though blowing up Starkiller Base seems like it would have been bad for Hux, the rage that Snoke has is more that his apprentice is not living up to the full potential and less that Hux is. So in the we're siblings trying to impress daddy relationship between Kylo Ren and General Hux, Hux is going to have the upper hand that Kylo Ren had at the beginning of The Force Awakens. He's moving. He's not the favorite son because he doesn't have force powers, but he's moving towards the favorite son because the other one's having daddy issues.
Because bureaucracy sometimes trumps superpowers.
Well, you know, he's got to fire those ventral cannons. Though that's going to be more important earlier on in Return of the Jedi than any sort of lightsaber plays.
We haven't really seen Kylo Ren exhibit great leadership so much as he has been very angry.
Yes, that's true. And then Hux, his story's sort of been complicated. Well, not his father's backstory has been completely laid out since The Force Awakens in the ancillary material. So my more and more feeling for poor little Hux. Poor little Armitage Hux. His father's name was Brendel. That's just an unfortunate family line of names.
Oh, this is great. Fantastic. All right. Well, Dave, I mean, we can talk about it more if you want to, but I really, really, really appreciate you playing coy Q&A with me. You're doing for me what Dave Chen usually makes me do for him for Game of Thrones, and I appreciate how hard it can be, and I appreciate all of your efforts to keep me pure for the next 48 hours until I see a new Star Wars with you in Los Angeles.
Yay! That's the punchline to the Star Wars segment.
Aww.
Joanna and I get to see it first. Sorry, Neil.
Well, this is less fun now.
No, I love you so much, Neil, but if I was... Dave was like, Joanna, if you give me your plus one, I will fly to Los Angeles to see the movie with you at the premiere. And I was like, well, how
that's
going to
be super fun.
Right.
I'm seeing it on Monday. So let's keep the Storm of Spoilers G chat clean until then.
I will say my favorite grouping of reactions was 2 years ago when we all saw The Force Awakens at the press screening. And then, like, we all got out about the same time. And there was a text message thread between, like, the three of us. I was like, that was good, right? Like, that was good. Like, we have a lot of good questions. Like, Star Wars isn't bad. We used to be worried that these things would be, like, straight up bad.
Right. Now we'll just be like, appalled if it's bad.
Exactly. It's further to fall, but in the Disney genericizing and franchise building, if we learn anything from Marvel, we'll probably be fine with it. Our expectations are going to genericize along with the product.
We're
That's
all
a downer
being
to end
genericized.
On. Genericized.
Or we might just be Weird and Laura Dern, the weirdest Star Wars character we've ever had. Yay!
Or it might just be Laura Dern.
I mean, it's always Laura Dern.
We didn't even talk
honest.
About the evil BB-8, but that might also end up being something of a fan favorite. We'll see if you got stuff to do. Until then, next week, we will all have seen Star Wars The Last Jedi, so I'm going to make a crazy call.
We're going to talk about something else.
Neil, what are we talking about next week?
We're talking about The Last Jedi.
Yeah.
Are we going to the casino of Canto Bite
sure.
next week?
Sure. All right.
So we're going to have an internal debate amongst ourselves about when next week's episode is going to drop, because I have a feeling we're all going to want to talk about spoilery stuff, but I also don't want to be a Grinch and drop all that on Wednesday and have you guys watching it in your iTunes feed and having to resist yourself, because I know how bad that pull is. So we're going to figure out when it's going to come out. We're going to talk about The Last Jedi.
Drop on Friday.
Friday, Thursday.
Definitely not
Wednesday.
Thursday. That's right.
We want to do it so you could leave the movie having seen it and instantly have us in your ears and yelling back at us and waking us up at night with your thoughts. But we don't want to ruin it for everybody. So we're gonna straddle that line. Thursday seems like a good bet. The Last Jedi. Calm and storm sections, why not? It's going to be great. Until then, guys, where can we find more of your work? on this magical internet. Let's go with Mr. Neil Miller first.
You can get me over at the old filmschoolrejects.com or follow me on Twitter at rejects. Also, don't forget, follow our show at Storm of Spoilers. And if you have any Last Jedi thoughts, questions, comments, things you would like us to know before we record an episode about The Last Jedi, you can email those to stormofspoilers@gmail.com.
And Miss Joanna Robinson?
You can find me at vanityfair.com. If you're Neil, you can find me in your mailbox.
Yeah. Actually, you're currently sitting on my kitchen counter.
Yeah. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can hear me talking about award season, which is getting super, super exciting and fun, on a special episode of Little Gold Men this week where we all four of us recorded in the same room in New York. And until then, I will see you guys in a galaxy far, far away next week.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. I'll put my New York Times watching link pinned to the top up there so you could prep yourself for The Last Jedi. Share with your grandma. It is made for your grandma. It has like moving images and everything. She's going to love it. And you could also go to findingthewarm.com to hear my other podcast.
I was getting really excited for you to say, I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on NewYorkTimes.com.
Oh, I'm Dave Gonzalez. You could find me on NewYorkTimes.com. I wish you could just go there and it'd be like, oh, did you mean Star Wars? But I don't want to drive people to NewYorkTimes.com because for all I know, the front page is like how all of our lives are ending. So if you just need to go to watching.NewYorkTimes.com, it'll be very easy to find from there. You can find it on my Twitter link. But most importantly, you will find all three of us giving you the skinny on a galaxy far, far away. Next week, live long and prosper. That's the right one, right?
No!